Here we go. This is, many of you remember Nick. Nick and I have done quite a few conversations. Nick, you've gathered a little bit of fame on my channel with your with your cult stories. And, you know, last week we even had a couple of conversations from Mary and from Cassidy about cults. But the time is yours. You wrote some interesting. I don't know if you want to respond, because I thought you left a lengthy comment, which I pinned to the top about.
I did. I saw that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could respond. I don't have a pre-planned discussion today. I have notes of like possible conversation topics, but it's a little less oriented than some of our previous conversations. Yeah.
Part of what I'm
wanted to have a conversation.
Yeah. It's part of what I'm thinking about, you know, as the channel grows and as requests for conversation outstrip my capacity to manage them, you know, part of what I'm thinking about is how to facilitate conversations with or without me on certain topics. And that the topics just sort of arise, and it's interesting that cults have been part of it. And I really appreciate a lot of your thought about, you know, I hadn't really thought about the history of cults until I talked to Mary, and Mary was mentioning this, you know, this thing that happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And when she was talking about it, it was like, oh yeah, I remember. I remember a lot of that. I was born in the, you know, early 60s. So, and I think, you know, you rightly noted that, you know, these dynamics that, you know, these dynamics that tended to be, let's say, pathologized, for lack of a better word, are go far beyond Heaven's Gate or maybe certain religious sectarian groups. These dynamics, these relational dynamics between us, as you know, I explored a little bit with Mary, these are common to, and as a pastor, these are common to watching a church work. And of course, the first thing my wife said to me, you met my wife at the, did you meet my wife at the, San Francisco?
Yeah.
The first thing my wife said to me, I said, I talked to a really interesting guy today. He'd been in like four cults. And my wife said, and now he's listening to you.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. Well, hopefully my presence is slightly more nuanced with all the stories than just the four cult guy.
Well, you haven't started a channel of your own yet, have you?
I have not, no. Okay. I have been making knives like an animal the last several weeks, which is funny. I was just commenting on the video you posted today about how, like, oh, we need to, like, kind of update our stuff. This looking backwards doesn't work well. Or, you know, not, we shouldn't not look backwards, but that kind of fixation on there was some magical time back there that we need to return to. And then, you know, I realize as I'm writing it, like, who am I to say anything? I sit here literally, two of the oldest human technology are like what I spend most of my time, you know, dealing with, bent sticks and sharp pieces of metal.
Metal's fairly new.
Yeah. So
if you're making flint knives, it'd be a whole lot older.
True. Yeah. 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 I was actually surprised. I was looking up about steel just last night, and we didn't know until the 1880s why any of our metallurgy or how any of it worked, which means for most human history, we were just doing magical rituals to make the steel better. We didn't know why any of it worked.
Yeah.
All the way up until like past the modern age. It's crazy to think
about. I've been doing a lot more thinking about Owen Barfield, and I'm working on a video. The next video I'm just doing myself will probably be quite a bit about Owen Barfield. And, you know, when you just said here, you know, doing magical things, I was thinking about, okay, why, you know, what is magic and why our fascination with it? And well, that's sort of, you know, we were doing these things because we knew we could, we were doing things in certain ways because we knew we could reliably achieve certain outcomes.
Yeah.
But why? And even, yeah, even now, in a sense, when you say, well, here's why, well, we've kind of got a layer beneath that maybe opens up some theories about other ways of doing things, but why?
I wrote a comment and then deleted it because I thought I was diving too far down a random rabbit hole. But
on my channel? In
yeah,
the comment section? Really?
Know, right?
No one does that.
I went so nuts on social media. Now I'm like hyper self-conscious of how I present myself. and what I was talking about was how you know, even atheists, like our sense for magical thinking. And it's weird using that word. You can use it in many different ways, but it's really, it's heuristics function on what we call magical thinking. And I was just commenting on how even the most rational minded person or whatever atheistic person, you know, they're assuming so much in the things that they do that they're actually employing magical thinking constantly throughout the day. And like an example I like to use, just because it's so basic and is, at least to my mind, easy to see, is washing our hands, you know, and how deep, like, we don't know what we kind of know, right? We know there's something called germs. We know putting the soap makes them go away. But the way we've heuristicized, I'm making words up now, that process, all we've done is called the bad stuff germs. And then we put the good stuff on that purifies us. And right, we do the whole ritual and do the thing, and you make sure to get in between your fingers because that's important, and carry out this ritual. And the crazy part about it is how deeply it impacts your psyche without you noticing it. So like, you know, I probably wash my hands upwards of 20 times a day just because I'm working with, I get lots of crud on them and oil and metal dust and all that kind of stuff. And it's some part of your mind is keeping track of how dirty your hands are getting throughout the day. And you don't even really realize it, right? It's not a conscious phenomena or process necessarily. But you start interacting with the world differently. You start making sure not to touch your face or not to eat your food with your hands, or all of these subtle changes to your behaviors and ways of acting out in the world start to shift. And then when you go through the purifying ritual, it changes in the other direction. And then all of a sudden you notice you're touching your face more, or you don't mind rubbing your eyes if they're tired, or, you know, all these other kinds of things. But it's what we're doing through that whole thing is magical thinking. And you can very directly tie the process of washing your hands to a baptism, right? And how it changes how you go about operating in the world at a really subconscious level.
That's right. When I lived in the Dominican Republic, you know, I was very conscious of this because I was living between two systems. So on one hand, I remember the house we lived with was a fair ways from the main street, and I didn't, you know, I'd taken public transportation. I had my son with me. It was starting to drizzle. My son was, you know, maybe 3 years old. I was carrying him. And so I'm walking through the neighborhood, and women start, you know, looking at me in horror. First of all, I'm a man. I don't know how to take care of a kid, you know. Second of all, I'm carrying my son in the drizzling rain. Se hace daño, se hace daño, they say. You know, you're hurting him, you're hurting him. It's like, I knew that, they call it creencias. I knew having your kid out in the rain, that hurts them. And so you'd have these things, you'd have, you know, the evil eye and all this stuff. But then I'd watch these North American teams come down and lecture on hygiene. And I just watch the Nationals listen. It's like, yeah, there's these things that you can't see. Let's call them germs.
Yeah.
And they're all over the place. And the way that you deal with them is you take these expensive products that you have to buy with money, and then you use them, and somehow the germs magically disappear. Okay. Now who's selling snake oil?
Yeah, right.
and you know, I love, you can find it on the internet. There's this great scene of this guy in Africa who's got DDT, and he puts it in a bowl with some porridge and is eating it in front of the tribe, and the tribe's looking back at him like, I ain't eating that stuff. And of course today we watch it. And
now we know how damaging.
And we say, I'm sitting with the tribe saying, I ain't eating that stuff.
But us, the enlightened Westerner at the time, was like, oh, it's totally safe. You know, spray it everywhere. It's not going to hurt anything.
and you can realize how silly we are.
Exactly.
And, you know, anti-vaxxers, I mean, that's a huge thing. And here in California, you know, it's often the people with the most education, it's in all the best school districts that the moms aren't getting their kids vaccinated. And this is a hot issue in the legislature. Well, recently there was some Hollywood celebrity that was down here at the Capitol in Sacramento, you know, protesting Dr. Pan, who's from my district, who put a lot of that, he's a pediatrician, you know, has been promoting a lot of the vaccination legislation. And so I just sit back and watch. It's like, I ain't getting between these two groups.
That's a weird one. It's a weird one. Yeah. And it's this way on any topic that you really, you know, dive into. And well, a large part of that is the rise of the internet, because you can find as much material supporting both sides of the argument as you want to find. Whereas before, you had, you know, the book written by the experts, and that's where you got to learn about it. And so they had a much more powerful effect in dictating the opinion isn't quite the right word, but it's something close to it. Educated opinion, I suppose.
Well, and what education is? Education is a system that collects around...
It's curation.
It's curation.
Yeah. It's actually hilarious. This leads right into one of my notes, but one of the fundamental ways that we create these cultic structures is curation. And that, getting into cult four, that's almost all they did. You know, there was a little bit of actual material that, you know, you could get into, but most of it was them just opening up into the chaos that is the internet and curating specific images and contrasting them against each other. And it's actually pretty amazing how much of a context you can create through so little effort of just curating, you know, bits of information.
Yes.
But then, you know, you can take that same idea and look at a college, and what is it? All it is vetted information. And that's the good thing with it. It's also the problem, because what happens when they start curating information that is, well, we all know how that goes.
Well, I've played bits of the video. It has Dallas Willard on it about worldviews on the Veritas Forum. I played bits of it in some of my videos in the past. And it's, so Dallas Willard taught philosophy at USC. He was a Husserl expert, so he's an expert on phenomenology. But he was also a deeply committed Christian. And he just made the observation that worldview is formed not so much by, you know, all of the things that the college says it is about, but by this entire social dynamic that, you know, I think Peterson talks well about. We're highly attuned to acceptance, rejection, possibilities, opportunities for status elevation, and vulnerabilities for status loss.
Yeah.
We are highly attuned to this. And these
probably one of our most sensitive systems for navigating the world.
Yep. And so systems develop. I mean, that part of what we're watching in terms of, you know, MAGA hats and Antifa and all of this stuff, part of what we're seeing is that now with the internet especially, these systems are really, you know, other systems kind of grow and, yeah, and we don't know what to do with them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and especially because in a sense, we've knocked out our own legs for dealing with that realm, right? Modernism knocked out the feet we were standing on to be able to deal in that realm strongly. So we had, in a sense, focused so much on one specific way of curating information and vetting people that we atrophied in many other directions that are now receiving enormous amounts of energy, and no one knows how to walk in those worlds, we could say.
Right. Dallas, the beginning of Dallas Willard's The Divine Conspiracy opens up with I think it was Robert Coles who made the observation. It was at Harvard. They were teaching, it was the Harvard Business School, and they were teaching business ethics. And one of the young female students came to Dr. Coles and said, "I'm dropping out of this course." He said, "Why?" She said, "Well, it's expensive, and to make my way through this school, I'm cleaning the rooms of a number of the other students in the class who are getting great grades in business ethics, and they keep hitting on me and groping on me and propositioning me while I clean their rooms." And right there, you have the contrast. You get an A in business ethics, but you know, all
you have
these
no
other, ethic.
Yeah,
that's right. but not be ethical at all.
There's no actual mechanism to enforce the practice of it. Instead, it's just the information of it. I even realized that responding to Luke, who commented back right before I got on the conversation with you, but he was talking about how liturgy is his answer, because I kind of critiqued him on, he critiqued, but he didn't come up with a response. And his response was historically rooted practices, and he described that as liturgy. And then I realized, like, oh yeah, I've made that argument, and I don't have a liturgical practice. You know, like, so what, you know, and that's the same thing. I'm sitting there taking the class at business school or, you know, business ethics. And yet, you know, I've played with it, certainly not historically based liturgy. You know, most formal Christians would be horrified at what I probably considered a liturgy, but
liturgy is a pretty broad word,
as
Jamie Smith, you know, the guy, the philosopher from Calvin College, continues to note. Well, our lives are full of liturgies.
Liturgy, that's true. Yeah. And that kind of ties back into our hand washing.
That's right. Yeah. Hitting on the girl cleaning up your room is a cultural liturgy. There's status involved. Yeah. There's, you know, and our movies are, you know, I remember when the movie Pretty Woman came out, I watched that movie and I thought, most of the nice middle-class people here ever seen real prostitution?
Probably not. A lot easier to romanticize it from...
I was once taking a guy, he was kind of a crippled guy, he was making his way down there, struck up a conversation right outside my office, and actually I almost hit him with the car, and he was just kind of making his way. I said, "Hop in, I'll give you a ride where you needed to go." So he hopped in and took him down to his house, and we were talking about all kinds of things. He was trying to get me to hire him to clean my car, because my car was messy, and he had gotten some packages over here at the package store. And I said, well, you know, have a good day. He says, I am going to have a good day. I got a girl coming, and there's this girl getting out of the car. It didn't look anything like Julia Roberts.
They usually don't if that's the way they're going about it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got us way off track.
No, that's what I was aiming for here. Have a fun conversation.
I liked what you put in there. Well, what you put in the notes, how the internet flattens salience through contradiction.
Yes. Yeah. So I have a whole little bit on this. There's actually kind of two parts to this. And I briefly touched on this, I think, in one of our previous talks, but it gets kind of back into that, you know, we don't have legs in this realm, or maybe it's better like to say we don't have fins for this realm. You know, we're still trying to walk on ground and we're now in water. And that also actually ties to another point. But man, I'm going to lose track if I don't watch myself.
Time goes fast.
It does. Yeah, so one of the problems, and I discussed this previously when trying to explain why the cultic frame is becoming so immediately prevalent, or salient, we should say. And that's because there's no other way to curate the internet. It's too big, you know? Like, just in the number of videos that are uploaded to YouTube in a single day, it would take a lifetime to watch that content production of a single day. It's too much. So we start having to use... this is the same. It's not like it's an any different problem. It's the same problem you have when you wake up in the morning and you are suddenly reintroduced to your room, and you have to navigate the room and figure out what's right. And usually the immediate salience is like, oh, I'm hungry, or I want my coffee, or I have to pee, or what, you know, like it.
Yep.
Curates the chaos that is reality suddenly down into something very manageable. Why I think it's so interesting with the internet is because there isn't any of these kind of fundamental drives. There are, but they're not as direct, or I don't know what the word is, right? The fundamental drives operating on the internet are things like our desire for relationship and our desire for attention. They're not as direct as, say, like our desire to eat a sandwich or whatever. So we have the drive to want to use the internet. The problem is that we don't have a strong mechanism for sorting the internet. And what that ends up forcing us to do is that when we first load up that browser, it's like we have to decide which of the million forms of content we're going to focus on for whatever specific story. You know, there's the recent story with the guy, I can't remember his name. I know his last name is NGO, which I don't know how to
pronounce. Oh, yeah, Andy Ng.
Antifa guy, yeah. The guy that got attacked by Antifa in Portland.
Right, in Portland.
And right immediately, and this is interesting because, like, when you look at what the algorithms are doing, what they're trying to do is make the internet digestible for you. They're trying to curate for you so that it creates a presentable image that makes you want to use that website over the one that's just absolute chaos. But with that one story, you have to pick which of the stories you're going to believe in before you even start watching the content, right? So it's you have to decide if you're for or against Antifa in that case before you go out and start looking, which is confusing. Decision we are making before we're even confronted with the content is that words are such a pain.
There's multiple layers here because, you know, one of the things that I learned along the way of this thing is that YouTube is a social media, and Google's desire is to keep you on YouTube as much as possible, similar to Facebook's desire, Twitter's desire. So they all build in these addiction qualities to keep us clicking onto the. And so, and obvious right now with the large conversations about YouTube and the increasing pressure of censorship, YouTube is radicalizing people because of, you know, recommended videos. And so we're going to no longer recommend videos from Jordan Peterson or Dennis Prager or Ben Shapiro, because I love how call any of these guys Nazis. It's like,
yeah, yeah, right.
Okay.
Again, like they have no choice at this point but to make it a cultic game.
Right.
Those are the bad ones. Right. We are the good ones. Now we're going to alter it, because otherwise it functions on the person's innate cultic instinct.
Yes. Yes.
Their own desire to see more of what they agree with, or at least even to find criticisms that they find more valuable than other criticisms. So, there's a lot of layers to this entire thing. So the internet itself is almost a perfectly flat salience field, again, because there's just every contradicting opinion that you could have. So the human response to this has been this, well, cultural framing. And we do it ourselves by choosing, you know, curating our own information. You know, we click the thumbs up or we click the thumbs down. We are curating. You know, we click on certain videos, not on others. We watch a lot of this, but not much of that. All of this. And then we're getting like a feedback loop between us and the algorithm. And then the algorithm's being controlled by some controller that has a cultic affiliation that they're trying to push. And it just starts to unravel quite quickly. And the other part of this is like the effect of clickbait. You know, why is clickbait so prevalent in a field where the highest quality information is available from every single possible angle? You know, why do we still, even when that's available to us, we still go for the low quality, the McDonald's? Well, that's probably a useful metaphor, actually.
Yeah.
Why do we eat McDonald's when you could have a steak? You know, part of it's the cost, but cost is also an effect here, except that the cost is in our attention span. You know, the amount of time it takes to actually have a nuanced view, or at least a depthful view on a topic, is a lot higher than the clickbait view. So we might not be paying with money, although attention is money on the internet. But we are still paying. And then
I think McDonald's is a good example, because I mean, why do people eat at McDonald's? Well, there's obviously who was the Spurlock did a Super Size Me, where he noted that, you know, the more he ate at McDonald's, the more he craved McDonald's. So there's probably a biological level going there. There's very much a risk reward. You know, the reward is low, but the risk is also low and the cost is low. And so you eat there. There are habits that form. I mean,
it blows out our senses.
Yes.
That's the other part. The salt is so salty.
Yes.
The sweet is so sweet.
Yes.
Even when you do come across the high quality foods, you don't crave them as much, because the refined taste of them is not, you've so muted your senses that you can't even pick up on them. All right. Your mouth is saying is, there's not enough salt. You know, where's all the salt? and that's the part, that's the other part of clickbait, is that it has this one, it stands out in the salience field. And then the other is that it also is literally changing our tastes, because it's so emotionally impactful that actually having a nuanced opinion and taking the time to go through and understand a topic deeply is just, we don't have the taste for it, you know?
I think that's a terrific metaphor for all of those reasons and more.
Yeah. Yeah. You can take it pretty far. And now comes the critique of capitalism.
No, that's very true. And so, you know, as someone who, I mean, my day job is curating religion, you know,
yeah,
curating God, curating the Bible, curating Christianity. I mean, many of those dynamics are very much in place. But, you know, say, you know, for example, when this whole process has been interesting for me because, you know, when I'm working on a sermon, I often notice one of the issues I have with a sermon, I've got really 20 to 30 minutes. That's my window with a sermon. Plus,
rough.
Interestingly enough, I've never really thought, you know, so my audience for the sermon, I do the rough draft on the channel, but here at church, my audience for the sermon is, I know who's showing up here. I know them quite well now. I've been here 20 years.
You're fine tuning it.
Yes.
Because you know the audience.
That's right.
Yeah.
But there's also a long tradition. So I can't just decide, oh, I'm really into this Jordan Peterson video this week. So my sermon this week is going to be on Jordan Peterson. Members of the church will often come up to me and they'll say, Pastor, you should preach a sermon on blank. And it's like, you've been going to this church for 50 years. Have you ever noticed that the Bible is somehow involved in the processing of the sermon? You know, I know there's a lot of pastors that do that, but I don't, in case you haven't noticed.
Well, you can see it standing out in their salience field for that week. And they're like, I have to, what's your opinion? And that's probably almost more of requesting a conversation, and they just don't know.
Well, usually it's, I have an idea that I want to colonize the rest of the church with. The church. Pastor, you do it for me. No.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work anyway. So then if they really push me, I say, well, let me ask you a question. You know, how many of the ideas that I've told you have you embraced? What you learn when you're a pastor? My favorite thing is when in the press people talk about pastors as if pastors are these grand mesmerizers who somehow have such abundant control over the minds of the people in their church. It's like, you've obviously never been to a church.
The mind control.
That's right.
Well, I wish. Make it a little easier at times. Yeah. That's interesting. You could also take that in the cultic direction with the ones where it is more directly mind control. I'm branching in a lot of weird directions. Let me try and rein it back in a little.
Your last question, go ahead.
Another interesting thing that might be, I've got two things I wanted to make sure I said something about, and this is one of them. That flat salience field that the internet presents, and I would actually say postmodernism is setting up the ground for a flattened salience, right? And in a way it's doing so by focusing us wholly on ourselves, and you kind of end up in the problem of like, you can't bite your own teeth. or you can't see your own, you know, your eye can't see itself, which has this dampening effect, right? You could almost call that like the point of Buddhism, is to flatten your salience so extremely that you become enlightened, I guess.
And also disappear, which is
disappear. Yeah. Well, and the literal stated goal of Buddhism is to remain permanently unmanifest.
Yes.
Right? To die and then not come back again, because everyone else is stuck coming back over and over again.
Right.
Which, yeah.
Well, it's a little ungenerous to die and not come back again, but to be absorbed in your individuality, your ego, you are, but in terms of a physical perspective, that pretty much is the same as death. Your body goes into the ground, the worms eat it, you simply become part of the
rest of the
right,
the larger system.
Yeah. Right.
A diffusion into, well, I'm sure that many Buddhists would consider it like a grander consciousness.
Right, right. Well, there's a value. There are value assumptions and assertions within that frame, just like every frame has them.
Yes.
And one of the things about Christianity, at least especially in the West, is the individual remains in Christianity. The individual rises. When Jesus rises from the dead, he's still him.
Yeah. Yeah. And that really is, at least from my experiences, was like the key insight, because I was coming from the direction of like trying to diffuse, trying to disown the self. And it is tricky because there is a point where they meet, which is to say you are in a sense disowning the self, because what you're doing is giving it back to God. And it's through the action of giving it back to God that you become truly yourself. Now you can hear my millennial voice in here, but so there is a juncture point there.
Yes.
But as experienced, it felt like a full allowing of who I am rather than trying to get rid of who I am. And again, I don't know, words start falling apart here. And the point I was going to make is that one way to look at the, I'm jumping so bad, sorry. To look at this postmodern condition is as a form of baptism, right? Correct me if I'm wrong here. There's two baptisms. There's the baptism of water, which is John the Baptist's baptism. And then there's the baptism of fire, which is the baptism to come. And we could, in a sense, call the internet, or even more broadly, the postmodern context, is this kind of submergence into the water. And there is a lot of this fear of drowning, right? Or Peterson's chaos is definitely the original symbol of chaos is the ocean. You know, that frames in the world and all these kind of old myths that, you know, the deep water.
That's interesting, because we use that language for the internet and information. You hear it again. Yeah. We're drowning
in information.
Information.
Yeah. This will probably be a little bit more dangerous for the audience. But we could say that, right, in the way that the baptism is in a sense preparing the person for the baptism of fire, right? It's the baptism of repentance. It's the cleansing. It's the preparing the body for, and this goes into like death rituals where they clean the body of the dead and prepare it for entering the afterlife, et cetera, et cetera.
Baptism, and I, you know, I've had my own journey with So one of the cool things is you become a pastor and people say, okay, I'll give you this job and buy lots of books and do a lot of reading and tell us stuff. Okay. And baptism is, baptism is it's an ordeal. It's a trial by water. Okay. And, you know, you can think about Monty Python and the witch trial.
The witch. Yeah.
A trial by water, in a sense, says we're going to take this person, throw them into the deep, and if they live, it's vindication by God. Now, what, say, Romans 6 does is takes that, and Romans 6 begins by saying you are baptized into Christ's life, you're baptized into Christ's death, you're baptized into his resurrection. And so baptism is this drowning of self. Now, when I worked with the Haitians, they acted this out, and the highfalutin pastors of the Capitol kept trying to come out to persuade the backwoods people that I was dealing with to stop. And I always let the backwoods people do what they wanted because I thought it was more interesting than the highly refined Capitol people. But so in baptism, you'd line up. I've got lots of pictures of this stuff. You'd line up by the river, and then they'd go in, or the water, or any water they'd have, and then they'd put them into the water. But then, as one of the missionaries, you know, so there's spirits all in the water, and there's spirits in the person. And a very ancient understanding of baptism is it's the drowning of the sinful nature, it's the drowning of the devil, it's the drowning of the spirits. And so they would put the person in the water and the person would start to thrash. And then the pastor would lean in, grab them and dunk them again. That pastor just kept dunking them until then they'd lay. And then, okay, once finally they surrendered to the spirit, then, okay, now they're baptized.
The baptism is finished.
None of this little sprinkling stuff, yeah. Baby. We got to drown them things out of them. I'd see missionaries and other pastors sometimes get offended by this, but I thought, no, I think they're acting out the drama of their death. This is an ordeal by water. And the reason we call it an ordeal and we have the other meanings of that word is that it is painful. It is an extreme.
Yeah.
And so you have ordeals by fire. That's basically Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's an ordeal by fire. The Christ's death is an ordeal by Roman crucifixion. And his resurrection is his vindication. Yeah. I mean, all of that is built into the Bible and into its symbology. And it only has sense because of it.
And the biblical flood.
Yes.
Has
yes.
a really strong tie to that baptism of water.
That's right. And when Moses, when they go through the Red Sea, Paul in 1 Corinthians talks about that as the baptism. Paul clearly is understanding how these things fit together.
Yeah.
They pass, and when they go into the promised land, they part the Jordan. That's a baptism through the Jordan.
Yeah.
They pass under the water.
On water as well.
That's right.
It has a really deep symbolism connection there. Especially
right.
that ability to, in a sense, touch the water of baptism, but not to fall into it.
That's
and
right.
And then the connection with the splitting of the Red Sea, because the person, there's no contact with the water.
Right.
It's not a baptism in the sense they didn't go under it. They're
That's
into
right.
it and they could breathe under it. No, they split it.
Right. Well,
separated
and,
the water.
And the Red Sea crossing is very interesting because they've got the Red Sea in front of them. They've got Pharaoh's army coming. And God says to Moses, you have only to be still to see your salvation. And it's like he's telling Moses very clearly, I will rescue you. And I have set up this situation so that you will be, and you see this, Peterson didn't bring this out nearly enough in going through Genesis, and I should probably go back over that stuff. But Peterson doesn't get the story of Jacob right, because, in my opinion, because so Jacob sends out his flocks and his wives and his kids, everything ahead as sort of a peace offering, as sort of a sacrifice to Esau, because he knows Esau's coming with 400 men, and Jacob's in fear of his life. And so God wrestles Jacob by the Jabbok River, by the stream, and, you know, I'm not going to let go of you till you bless me. Then God touches his hip, and he's lame. God takes away, Jacob's last resort. The last thing last power Jacob has to save himself from Esau is mobility. And God says, I'm taking even this away from you.
Yeah.
Will you trust me? Because it's all set up by Bethel. God says to him, if you read the story, God says to him, I'm going to give you all this. And Jacob wakes up from the dream and says, if you give it to me, I'll give you 10%. It's like, wait a minute.
That's the wrong order. Yeah,
told you he was going to give it to you. And Jacob never believes. Abraham didn't believe. Jacob didn't believe. That's the heart of the story. And God, again and again in the Old Testament, says, y'all have serious trust issues. That's right. I'm going to do it. I want you to trust me. And we find every other way not to trust. And that's the heart of those stories.
Yeah.
And nothing like an ordeal to
force you into trust.
That's right. Because you have no other option.
Yeah.
And as a pastor in ministry, you know, you think, well, these are dramatic stories. No, you know what? That happens to all of us.
Everyone. Yeah. Yep. Everyone has the trial at some point. And, that was a great tangent, but I forgot what we were. Oh, yeah. The final bit of that I was going to bring up as well is that it is almost, in a sense, this postmodern context. I hate using that word. It should really have a better name. a figure like Christ can actually rise. Right? It is, in a sense, it is purifying. It does have this equalizing effect. And a Christ is not going to arise in the modern context. A scholar will, a Pharisee might, right? Like, it's not to say he can't. I'm not trying to make an argument about the powers and such. But it is, there is seemingly a conjunction between how the world is moving and how these figures step in to synthesize with the world in a way that is overly perfect. And I do see the potential in this context for that to happen, where it has not been at least as obviously available for a while. So I don't think, it's not to say we should accept it, but it is to say it's forcing us to focus on something that is very important. And I do think that there is a great lesson to be learned that is something other than just, oh, this is too far. Let's run back to where the ground was safe. You know, it really is. We're stuck in the unknown. We've taken that step off the cliff, and now it's kind of you got to develop faith in such a circumstance.
That's right. Well, because you got nothing. I mean, you got, one of the things that I've been reading Fatal Discord, which is a book about Erasmus and Luther. And it's really a wonderful book in terms of, if you want a book that has lots of little bios of many of the critical figures in this conversation of the Protestant Reformation, the author does a really nice job of it. But one of the things that you begin to realize if you read church history is that Christianity's apocalyptic aspect has been present at every age. And what's interesting about our times now, you know, growing up, it was the Cold War for me, very real possibility of a slip up or, you know, a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Baptism of fire.
Yes, baptism of fire. And going to church, people very readily read passages from apocalyptic passages from the Gospels or the Book of Revelation as stars falling from the sky. Those are ICBMs.
Yeah.
You had a whole cottage industry and evangelicalism.
It is crazy to think, right, 2,000 years ago, everyone saying baptism by fire. I could imagine them saying, how is that going to happen? You're going to light the whole world on fire? Yeah. Like, all right, whatever. And then 2,000 years later, we literally have the capability to light the whole world on fire.
Yeah. So, well, and they experienced, you know.
There's meteors and comets.
But also volcanoes.
Volcanoes.
You know, what did in the cities on the plain? Yeah. Because those cities on the plain were done in. You know, these Genesis, people like to think that these Genesis stories were just made up from whole cloth. You know, stuff happened there. And even if you don't believe, even if you're if you don't believe anything, quote unquote, supernatural, these stories were written because of stories in the past from people.
Yeah.
And well, now, you know, we're in this moment of, well, you know, we seem to not be as anxious about nuclear annihilation, which how well-formed that is, I don't know.
Yeah.
But now it's environmental apocalypse. And the irony is that we both lack sufficient coordination between nations and self-control. And it's like, these are all the same issues.
Well, and we're just raising the stakes.
That's right.
Like,
that's right.
Higher and higher and higher.
That's right.
What's the lesson there? Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing. It's God knocking out Jacob's hip.
That's right. That's right. Now will you trust me?
Yeah.
I can do everything but trust you. Okay. Keep playing. And you know, early on, I always thought, you know, here's the scary thing about God is that, you know, if you try and avoid him, I mean, he's got means that, and everybody's life, this is the crazy thing. Everybody gets sick and dies. Everything always falls apart for everyone. That's why about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, started talking about the age of decay, because we all lose everything.
Yeah.
Nobody gets out of this world alive.
Nope. Zero. And it would almost be worse if you did. At least in the way we imagine what that would look like, a permanent extension of the age of decay.
Yeah.
Frozen age of decay, we could say.
And then Christians get all, well, God won't let these bad things happen. It's like, have you read the Bible?
Yeah, I don't know about that one. He seems to not care a whole lot about what we think is bad for us.
That's right. the Babylonians came down. The northern kingdoms wiped out. Just even in history, the Black Death. Yeah. God didn't stop that.
No. Well, and that was, again, with my own rather intense experiences, that was like a major realization, because you get so used to this image of God as the old man that's very disengaged or whatever that image is that we've kind of developed somewhere. And experiencing it firsthand was like, oh no, that's not it at all. It's dynamic. And it doesn't care, right? It's I don't know of a good way to. Oh, yeah, Kendrick Lamar has a song, "God is Gangster," which, right? It's goofy, but that's the feeling. It's like, no, all the things you think are safe because of what you think the moral code is not. That's not the rules. That's not the game that's being played. There's no, you know. You have the rules. God doesn't have them.
That's right. it's like when the little kids see that the parents can stay up late. Why don't you have a bedtime?
Yeah, exactly.
Go to bed.
Right, and that's the entire atheist critique is, how come you don't have to go to bed? that's the heart of it.
Oh, you thought he was just one of us?
Yeah. Just a bigger, older person.
Yeah. It's like, no. And that's, to me, why Jordan Peterson God number one thing is like, no, you don't understand. You know, people get all offended at Calvinism, and I say, okay, what about me being born to wonderful parents in North America and all these other people born to grim places with ill health all over the world? What part of not choosing is involved in that? Yeah. Just because you, in a sense, have a process, this gets back to the hand washing. Just because there's a system there that you've sort of come to terms with, then and now suddenly, well, that's okay. Oh, really? Why is it okay that I was born to a wonderful family in Paterson, New Jersey, and these people in Haiti were born to suffer and die?
Yeah.
Why is that okay?
Yeah.
Well, no, okay, yeah, so then you? God is evil, and I'm going to stick my finger. Well, you want to do that, go ahead. If you think it'll help. I don't really have a lot of confidence. You know, people didn't do so this foolishness.
Situation, yeah. Oh, gosh.
It's just stupid people tricks.
Yeah. And that's, I remember after our ineffable conversation, there was a comment I responded to with the person commenting on how I'm about to enter another cult. And it's like, well, first of all, yeah, but no. And then second of all, you know, no matter which way you cut it, having a learned authority over God is not, like, you're going to have to humble yourself no matter which way you go about it, you know? And there is a part of that. I do like that aspect of the predestination in the sense that it forces you into a state of humility. There's no way to get out of it, you know? And it functions on both ends of the spectrum, right? It functions for those that were given less and those that were given more. It forces both into the state of humility before God, if not humility in a worldly sense necessarily. That gets tricky, but.
And it doesn't, well, and I've never seen it as, so on one hand, the Bible has, you know, divine election, predestination. And the other, the Bible is just full of admonitions to take action and choose and decide. And
yes.
And they're both in the Bible. And people look at that and say, well, we won't look at the predestination. We'll just look at these. Or that some Calvinists do the other thing. And it's like, no, they're both there.
Yeah.
Which means on one hand, you have to live in both systems.
Yes.
You do.
Yes. And that's, you know, this is always the problem, regardless of which polarity you're trying to deal with, is that there is some magical synthesis in the middle of them, you know, and that's where we get back into the ineffable, where it's like, well, I have free will because I gave my free will away, you know, like there's a spot where that sentence, which is totally nonsensical, makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You don't get to say it in a way where now everyone's going to understand or be able to experience it as you did.
Well, and I think one of the things we can't do is communicate it because it's something too big for us to grasp with our words. And that sounds like a horrible cop out. And I completely understand that. And that's why everybody's, oh, it's a mystery. That sounds so lazy.
Right.
But
you can grasp it with a life.
Yes.
That's the part.
Yes. That's exactly right.
You know, you don't get to be the master of it. You don't get to sit in your chair and tell everyone how it is.
Right.
But you can act it out.
Yes, yes.
You know, yes. That's where that synthesis actually happens.
Yes, yes.
And that's what, again, that's what we see and it's what the Bible's telling us over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm working on a video doing some thinking about the Owen Barfield stuff. And you know, one of the questions that I keep thinking about is, I just right before you had a terrific conversation with a guy who's getting his master's in philosophy in Quebec. And that'll be a fun conversation to post. I'll these conversations always get delayed because I kind of save them up for vacation when I'm not making my own videos. But, you know, one of the questions is materialists. I mean, it's always the, from the bottom up, they're like, well, what's the, you know, all this ideal stuff, ideas and things, you know, that's all. Or the idealists think that the bottom end is all, you know, and we're always caught in the middle between these two ends. And so one of the questions that I'm always wrestling with is, okay, so what is the point of matter? I'm not a Gnostic, you know, what is the point of matter and materiality and physicality? And I think part of it is, in fact, and it seems strange that it's communication, that materiality communicates in a way that words cannot. And that's why what you said just a minute ago, you grasp it with your life, which means you grasp it with your body.
Yes, absolutely. The symbol of Christ is exactly that.
Yes.
That's why it's so powerful. You know, I guess I don't even like the way I'm saying it. So powerful a symbol? Like, no, that's not what I'm trying to say. But so powerful a story. I can't think of the right word. But it's exactly that. You're feeling it as what was grasped with a life. That's the manifest aspect of God, fully manifest aspect, is exactly that. You're grabbing it with your body. And that's, I would argue, that's the point of these stories, is that you're meant to feel them in your body, not as an abstract emotion, not as an abstract thought, but literally a physical sensation that informs how you go about living. And I think that that's a big part of, you know, like whatever a person might call a spiritual path, I think it has a whole lot more to do with the body than it does with the spirit. You know, it's not an abstraction. It's not. And that's tricky because it really depends on how you're defining spirit. But it really is this fundamental change in the embodied experience of existing.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Well, you have anything on your list that we didn't get to? You're the last talk today, and I don't have to run out. So we got a little.
Oh, nice. Oh yeah, we're past the time already. My goodness. Every time. I think
when I get them stacked up, I gotta quit because I got the next guy, but I don't have anyone after you today.
Coming. Nice. I had one brief idea that I thought was fun that I've been kind of thinking on for a little bit. And that's just the idea. This relates back to the internet and social media. But I got it looking into the uncanny valley. Have you heard about the uncanny valley?
Yes.
So I think that another major part of what a lot of the problem with people's reaction to social media is that we are, in a sense, stuck in the uncanny valley. And for people that are unfamiliar, I'll try and give a quick rundown. The uncanny valley is a dip in people's emotional responses to things that are moving from the abstract to more human-like. So, right, the far abstract, a stick figure, we have almost zero emotional response to. But a cartoon, we have a very high positive emotional response to. This keeps going until it starts to go down as we get really close to human, and then it jumps back up once you get all the way to human. So what I like to use as the example, just because it's so familiar, or I hope it is, the pit of that uncanny valley we could call the Wax Museum. You know, like, they're unsettling places to see a wax sculpture.
Yeah.
And I've been relating that to social media in the sense that we have, in a sense, locked ourselves into this uncanny valley, particularly with a lot of the more image-focused forms of social media. So those like Instagram, Facebook, maybe Twitter. And right, once you get into YouTube, you're kind of coming back up on the upswing if you're watching, you know, people actually be themselves. So I was just thinking, like, there's two ways to get out of the uncanny valley, and I think you actually see this in how people use social media. You can move towards the cartoonish, or you can move further towards the hyper-realistic. And my general answer has been like, oh, we need to move further towards the hyper-realistic. Be a real person, you know, on the internet. Do that. I tried that one pretty hard. It's chaotic, to put it mildly. And then the other is you see a lot of very positive reactions to the hyper-cartoonish. People that are joking or being fake or putting on a show, but they also know they're doing it. They're doing it intentionally. And that really deep negative reaction is to those that are putting on a show that think they're being real. Right? That's where we get this, like, urge to destroy, for lack of a better word, right? It's, we want to go into the wax museum with a bat and start swinging. And that's exactly what people do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that I meant to tie in earlier in our conversation with the discussion on salience, but I did think it was a useful metaphor that hopefully people can play around with. And I like it because it presents solutions to it. It doesn't just demonize social media as the terrible thing, but it's like, well, you can kind of shift around with how you're using it and see if it, you know, the dynamics change.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting application of the idea because, you know, it's often used when applying, let's say, every now and then someone decides to do an animated lifelike movie or Princess Leia, you know, after she's dead, you know, she keeps going in the movies and you're watching like,
something is off. Yeah.
Yes.
Robotics as well. Is
yeah.
The other common one, animation and robotics.
Yeah. But in social media, so you have, you know, in Facebook and Instagram, let's say in particular, where people are presenting, these are photographs of themselves. And it's obviously a presentation, a representation, maybe even a distortion. And
once you start adding the filters in, like Instagram is all filters. That's what made it popular to begin with.
Yeah.
Right. We're tweaking that reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it pushes it. And it, you're right. Like we're flirting right on the edge of that human and something else.
Yes. Yes.
And again, people are going to fall on either side of that depending on a lot of their context
or
cultural affiliations.
Yes.
You know, they're going to see what another person sees as a wax doll and think it's totally real.
Yes.
Because they're operating in the same context.
Yep.
So that's where you also start to see like the cult battling.
Yep.
You know, and you get this dehumanizing effect that's really intense. And I think it really is. People think they're swinging at wax dolls. And in a sense, they are, because the person on the other end, that's what they've shown them.
Right.
You know? Except that's not who's receiving it. You know, who's receiving it is the person.
Right. Well, and you know, again, back to swinging back to the Antifa stuff, throwing all the milkshakes. How did that start? I have no idea. But
no idea.
Throwing all the milkshakes at that guy, beating him up.
Yeah,
it's, you know, there was a tremendous amount of anxiety about violent video games not that long ago.
Yeah,
and in the end, people, there was no scientific correlation between, you know, playing Call of Duty with being a mass shooter, but it you wonder if in fact social media is more of a concern in cases like these, yeah. where
it probably is, ironically. And it is exactly because when we're playing the video game, it's firmly in cartoon land.
Yes.
You know, we know it's the person, we know it's fake.
Yep.
But when you're flirting on the edge of, you know, wax doll or real person.
Yep. Yep.
That's where you're in a very dangerous territory.
Yep.
Because they didn't see him.
Yep.
You know, they didn't see the person, the gay Asian guy
yep.
during Pride. Like, you know, like, if you're a far leftist, this guy should have been one of your last targets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if he had an opinion you disagreed with. So it's, yeah, you know, it really is there is a severe aspect of danger there. And again, I don't like the idea of blaming the tool so much as like, there's ways in which the tool operates that are certainly bad, not helping.
Yep.
But the other part of it is you can only blame the tool so much. You know, I have a bandsaw in my thing here. It is an amazing tool. So powerful. I can do so much with it. Yeah. But the moment I touch my finger to that thing, it's gone. Gone.
Yeah.
So I could sit there blaming the tool for being too powerful. Yeah. Or I can go be scared of it, you know,
yes.
aware of it, know what it's capable of.
Have the fear of the bandsaw in you.
Yes. Yeah. It's a good fear to have as a woodworker.
It is. It's very, I, when I was at that lumberyard before we were recording, I talked about my summers in a lumberyard. One of the grandfather of a, he was actually a classmate of mine. He worked there too. He had worked in that shop for how many years, and just one day, fing, tip of his thumb, right off, that fast, you know? But put your round of sawdust, grab that.
Yep. It's ever more dangerous the more familiar you are with it.
Yep.
And I think about that every time I go on the show. I mean, I just drilled a hole in my thumb, so who the hell am I to talk about? It was a tool I thought it was safe.
Yeah.
You know, I was using a Dremel and just, you know. But it is. It's when you think you're safe. It's when you're super familiar with it.
Yeah.
And again, you can relate that to social media. It's when you're super familiar with it that it becomes most dangerous.
That's true. Well, Nick, this again has been a pleasure.
Yes, definitely.
And it's always good talking to you and fun seeing you when we can connect up. We do have I'm wanting to do a meetup again at some point we might do another one in San Jose, which obviously is a lot closer to you. So if we get something organized, I'll let you know.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd very much enjoy that.
Well, yes, I hope
it was wonderful as always. I always greatly enjoy talking with you.
Well, I hope you continue to respect the bandsaw.
Yes, I as well.
Keep all your fingers.
Yes, I'm kept them so far, but I'm also not that old.
Yeah. All right, take care.
See you, Paul.
Bye-bye.